Hi, this is Brennan Davis from Bedrock Games and the Bedrock Blog, and I'm here with Adam, and we're doing kind of a mini podcast today, or at least a focused podcast, where Adam saw a touch of Zen. I'm sorry?
I said, we'll see how long it goes.
Adam saw a touch of Zen for the first time, and I said to him, oh, when you finish, tell me, and I'll watch it again, and we'll talk about it. This isn't going to be like an in-depth coverage of it. I only saw it once again, like 2 days ago, I think, and I don't know when you finished watching it. Maybe that was probably around that same time. So,
yeah.
But I was very curious about Adam's reaction to the movie. And I do have deeper coverage of it on a previous video podcast. If I can find it, I'll link it. I know it's on my YouTube channel. And we might have even done an episode on A Touch of Zen long ago at one point, but I can't recall. And I don't know who would have been involved if we had done it. But all right, so I guess to give people the breakdown, just in case they don't know about this movie, A Touch of Zen is a 1971 film directed, co-edited, and written by King Hu. King Hu is kind of an auteur, so he had a lot of involvement in everything down to like the clothing and costumes. And I think he drained his own finances to pay for the set design because it was like a 9-month project. And this movie is considered by many people to be his masterpiece. I don't want to say anything that's untrue, but my memory is it wasn't quite as well received when it came out as it is viewed now. I could be wrong on that. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of did some research. Basically, it kind of bombed when it came out in the theater in Taiwan in 69, I think. But then a few years later, it went to the Cannes Film Festival, and it was one of the final kind of finalists to win the Palme d'Or there. So it suddenly became critically acclaimed. It became this.
Well, and I think, too, it was released in two parts initially, which is kind of weird because this is an odd movie to watch. Perhaps. I've always wondered about, like, you could sort of see it with an intermission, but to actually wait time to watch the second half seems kind of odd to me.
I would have felt unsatisfied if I had to wait a year after watching the first half of this, definitely.
So what was your reaction to it? Like, I mean, you've probably heard about it a lot and heard it's like this great movie, but actually seeing it, what were your feelings?
Actually seeing it, I really like this. It does start slow. You need to be patient with this movie, but even during the slow parts, just to give some sense of this movie, it's very different than, say, a Shaw Brothers movie, which are very much movies, have a lot of sets and that kind of thing. The locations in this and everything felt very real. It's like, and the slow pace of it, you know, the main character being a painter and calligrapher, you watch him at the beginning of it going through the process of opening his stall, mixing his inks, kind of getting all set up. You kind of watch him at work when a mysterious client enters, and there's just this real feeling of reality to this movie that a lot of wuxia movies don't have. And this character, the main character, being just this artist as opposed to being a martial hero. There are full-fledged wuxia type characters in this movie, but they're at the beginning of the movie, they're very much on the periphery. You're kind of spending the first hour kind of dealing with this one character who's slowly getting involved with this larger plot.
I think the first fight you actually see is when the official who's trying to track down the fugitives finds the general masquerading as an old man and punches him in the back or something, right? And it's not really a fight. It's more like a moment that happens, and it's very, like you're saying, it's very
real. A moment of bullying.
Yeah, a moment of bullying. It's sort of what it feels like. But yeah, I agree with you. It's set outside, obviously. It focuses a lot on mundane details initially. It's a 3-hour movie, so it takes its time. The thing that I've sort of come to realize about King Hu, this might be an unfair label because it's sort of like retroactively affixing something to him that doesn't really apply to a different time and place. But I think if you appreciate a King Hu movie as a hangout movie, it works better. And the reason I employ hangout movies is because hangout movies are films where you're not worried about the plot happening. You're worried about getting to know the characters and you're enjoying spending time with the characters. And so this is exactly that kind of movie. There is a plot, stuff does happen, but it kind of slowly creeps up on you. And if you're sitting there waiting for the plot to unfold in a King Who movie, especially after the In trilogy has been completed, you know, his later King Who movies, I feel like you're too much of a state of anticipation, and you ruin the experience for yourself of enjoying the movie. So that's the way that I've come to appreciate a movie like this, is that it's a little bit more of a hangout movie, at least initially. And
you're watching his relationship with his mother and how his mother wants him to go take the exams to become a scholar and an official and everything. And yeah, and it's engaging. Like, the mother character is a really good character. I enjoyed that character a lot. You got a sense of this town, in this little remote mountain town. I mean, as someone that runs role-playing games in this genre, one thing you really get out of this movie is just a sense of life to it, of daily life that you don't get from a lot of wuxia movies.
Yeah, and I did my coverage of Legend of the Mountain, which is another King Who movie, I made the same comment because even though it's this remote place where there's like three people living there, you get this real sense of place. And this movie does that too. I also agree with you on the mom. I like the mom character. She feels like a real mother. And I like that the scholar is somebody who we're sort of getting to know, and we're kind of discovering that, like, maybe you never fully know what any of the characters are feeling. Like, for example, and I'm jumping ahead, but the Miss Yang character played by Xu Feng, when later in the story, and I'm going to spoil things, one of the plot points is her and Gu, the scholar that Adam is talking about, they have sex. And they have sex because she basically wants to reciprocate to the Yang family and help them get an heir. And so later he comes to the monastery where she's living. He takes the baby, and she kind of stares wistfully at them as they go off in the distance. And you know that she's moved by it, but you're not sure. Is she moved because she's like feeling the loss of her child that she's giving to this man? Or is she moved because she's feeling like that's a life that she can't have? Like, does she want to be with Gu? Like, he's not. They seem like an odd pairing. So I think on initial viewing, you tend to think, oh, she looks down on him. Perhaps she might not want to be with him. But he actually does demonstrate a lot of very tremendous qualities. He's part of the reason why they are able to survive when they're in hiding, because of his cunning and his ability to use military tactics. So even though she's sort of more on the, you know, masculine side, her name is Yang, right? She's on the masculine side. And he's more on the feminine side. Part of me wonders when I see that scene if she wanted to be with him. And the same thing with him. Why does he not want to take the exams? Is it because he's too righteous and he doesn't want to get involved in the corruption of the world? Is it that he just wants to be a painter? Is it, you know, you don't know, but I like that you have a strong sense that there is this internal world to these characters, but you kind of have to guess at what's actually going on.
Yeah, which adds to their reality. It's like when movies kind of explain, oh, this person is doing this because of this. It's like that's not how real people are. Like, it could be a combination of those things. And yeah, I it's interesting too, you mentioned kind of the fact that the scholar and I should have the characters.
Oh, Miss Yang.
That they, you know, they do have sex at one point kind of relatively early in the movie. Yep. And that scene completely perplexed me. The first time, it's like, why did that happen? Why did she do that? There wasn't any real chemistry going on. And it kind of comes up, later on in the movie, it pays off. And you're like, oh, okay. It's still strange, but it's understandably a strange thing that she does. Well,
what I got from it is that she was interested in leaving the world and seeking the spiritual life. She wants to go to the monastery, and this family had protected her. You know what I mean? They had, you know, it was like the one thing that she could do, even though she's not the most feminine character at all. She's a very masculine female lead.
Yeah.
But it's the one, it's sort of the one thing that she can do as a woman to reciprocate to this family, I think was her thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It's definitely an unusual way to reciprocate.
It also could just be the fact too. It's like, you know, before she takes her vows and goes into here, this is her last, she's kind of having a little taste of the world before she gives it up too. So there could be an element of that as well, but it never spells it out, which I think is to the movie's benefit.
And that's also the only time we see her behaving in a feminine way. She puts on makeup. She plays. Yeah,
that's right. Jung.
She's. I think she's singing a Levi poem. So it's.
Yeah, because he did have the makeup and stuff. There was a moment I was like, "Is this the same character or not?" She was so characteristically different during that scene.
I mean, Xu Feng has a tough face, but she can look very feminine. I've seen her in a lot of movies where she, you know, plays a more feminine role. But I like it. She just, I mean, it's almost like a tomboy quality to her character, right? She's just like she looks like she's about to punch you in the face. That's kind of the resting expression, I feel like, her character.
Yeah, she has a very strong face, definitely. But very attractive at the same time. She's got a very interesting face, I would say.
Yeah, well, he's used her in a lot of movies. So I think he must have, I think that with a director like, you know, and he's used that, Shi Chun, the guy who plays Gu, also, who also has a very striking face, a very memorable face. You know what I mean? He in Dragon Inn, he played the lead. He played the hero in Dragon Inn. Interestingly,
yeah, we watched Dragon Inn back in Wuxia Weekend years ago, and it's like I've actually just picked that up at the same time I bought this. I'm looking forward to that because I barely remember watching that, so I'm really excited to go back to it.
He plays the guy with the parasol in that. There's a couple of things. Both these movies feature Eastern Depot. And I guess the reason for that is a lot of these films, these two films, I think in particular, King Hu was kind of commenting on the James Bond phenomenon and what he saw as its potential. Like, you know, even if this secret government organization is being used for good, ultimately it's going to be corrupted and used for bad. And so that's why he wants to feature Eastern Depot in it. And that's why his hero is this guy rather than a James Bond type guy.
It's interesting because I just by coincidence rewatched Flying Swords of the Dragon Gate recently, and I was like, oh, hey, it's the, I think that's got, I believe that has Eastern Depot.
They all feature Eastern Depot, I think, all of the Dragon Inn movies.
But
that's a connecting point. The other one is Zhu Feng plays a very similar character in Dragon Inn. I don't know if you remember, and it's been a while since I've seen it too, so I probably won't get the plot. Like, I'm not gonna be able to accurately give you the plot 100%, but she plays the daughter of an official. There's like, I think it's like two or three of the official's children they're trying to escort to the inn to get them to safety, and she's one of the children. Now it's a different official. I think that I have the name here if I can remember it. It's let's see, I can't find it, but it's the official has a different name. But the point that I'm making is you can almost see them as sort of vaguely, they're tied together by the fact that, like, visually, it's almost like a sequel to that story. Do you know what I mean? Like, with her character.
I have to say, this movie really came alive for me during the part where that guy who's come from Eastern Depot hunting for them, after starts painting his portrait and he wanders off and Gu's following him as he's following the other guy, and that whole sequence, that, you know, I was kind of vaguely interested in what was happening, but that I was like, ooh, that's so, and then the monk showing up, and it's such a fantastic sequence there.
No, and that monk showing up in that way, I feel like that's been emulated in a lot of movies too. But what I like about King Hu movies, and I think you really see it in that scene, is they're shot kind of more like silent films. I think we were having this conversation where George Lucas had said Star Wars was, he actually intended it to look like a silent movie. That's why music is so important. Now, again, it's George Lucas, so I don't know how much, you know, take everything he says with a grain of salt. But But it makes sense when you he does say a lot of things, but that thing actually makes sense when I go back and look at Star Wars. It looks like a solid film. Totally. I think it's maybe one of the reasons why I like Star Wars so much. Touches Zen, Dragon Inn, Painted Skin, you know, all the King Hu movies, and this is true of a lot of Chinese film and a lot of Taiwanese film, but I think with King Hu especially, there is like a I get the same sense that I get watching the characters sort of lean back like that, or do you know what I mean? That lean back reaction shot that they do all the time. It reminds me of Phantom of the Opera. I was just watching the silent movie again. And, you know, when he unmasks and she leans back, it's that kind of acting. I love that kind of acting. And I think that scene, it physically works for me for that reason, because it's like this, it's about the movement of the figures on the screen. Do you know what I mean? Like it pays attention to that.
Yeah. And it's very, at the same time, it's very naturalistic. Him just moving through the town, you're following it, you're observing things, no one's saying anything. You're just picking up, like, why is this guy running away now? Where is he going? What's this guy up to? It's just letting you speculate about what's going on in that scene. And it really pulled me in.
The other thing I like about this movie is the scene where Gu sort of fakes out the officials by making them think that the fort is haunted, and then sets up these traps. And basically, it's interesting because up until that point, he's really been this feeble, effete, not terribly useful character in contrast to Miss Yang. And he offers his services to her because he explains, like, he's visibly studied the classics. He knows military strategy. He understands all of these different things, and he's able to come up with a plan that'll help them defeat greater numbers, which they're sure to face. And number one, what I like about it is just there's a whimsy to it. Like the scene where they're in there, the officials have come in, they're sort of picking them off one by one, and Miss Yang faces off with one, and she has a moment of hesitation where she doesn't want to kill him because she sees the look on his face. And Gu pops out of a window and says, he says, I have it written down here, your womanly kindness will impede our success. And I don't know if he's quoting a classic or not, but it's that kind of scholarly sort of,
it sounded like a quote, definitely, the way he said it.
But I just love that scene because he sort of has this moment of ruthlessness that's unexpected. And then after, he's looking around at the carnage and laughing. And he's laughing, and at first he just sees the dummies that they set up, and so they're like fake bodies. But then he sees the real bodies and he realizes, oh my God, like, you know, people I know have died. Like he has the reality of it sets in. And so we were given this whole scene where we were rooting for him the whole way through to murder the officials. But then King Hu doesn't stop at that. And he sort of forces us to deal with the consequences of it. And I think that's interesting when you consider the final themes of the movie of the Buddhist monk who's trying to not kill the bad guy. He's doing his best to sort of stay his hand and get the guy to learn. I just that scene always stands out to me. The way that Gu goes from like reveling in what he's done, and then suddenly he's horrified by the outcome of his own actions.
Well, I mean, it brings up the fact, too, that he is, you know, he knows all this military stuff. He's an expert on military strategy, but he has absolutely no real experience. And even though he was successful, he was not prepared for what he was doing.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the Burn After Reading scene where George Clooney shoots, I think, Brad Pitt in the closet. He's been trained for the act of killing, and he talks about that. He's like, oh, yeah, I know, you know, I'm trained to react to kill, but he's never been trained to deal with the aftermath of killing somebody. And so he just completely freaks out and becomes like a mess of a human being. It reminds me a little bit of that, sort of like you're saying, like he's not really equipped to deal with the reality of what he's doing.
And obviously it's like, you know, it's not like all these people were villains. It's like, I mean, obviously the people behind this are, the corrupt officials behind all this are villains, but who did he kill? He killed, like, you know, 50 just guys that were typical soldiers. And it's, yeah, it really kind of lands.
The other thing too, I was curious about is how you felt about the fight scenes? Cause we do get fight scenes eventually.
It takes a while.
But I'm curious what your thoughts on those were, if you know, just having, because you've seen a number of martial arts movies now.
A number, yes. A very high number. But I thought the fight scenes in this were fantastic. They're all very impactful. In fact, the slower pace of the movie makes them really land. Sometimes you watch a wuxia movie and there's a fight every like 5 minutes, and it's almost overwhelming. But it's like every time there's action in this movie, it's significant.
And, yeah.
It's very powerful.
I like how, like, this is one of those movies where when the swords clash, you feel it. There's like weight to the swords. And I like the Xu Feng character, Miss Yang, when she's fighting, she has a very masculine style of fighting. I can't even visually and physically, I can't figure out what they were doing to get this effect, but she's constantly crossing swords with the guy, and then she's pressing forward with this. You know what I mean? She's sort of like, the swords get interlocked, and then she advances forward, and like she just keeps pressing on him and pressing on him. At least I think in the fight with Ouyang, one of the early officials that she's dealing with. It was a very interesting stylistic choice, I thought. And also the bamboo forest scene is amazing. But what I really like is the scene where the monks, like, you see everybody, like, throughout the movie, we see characters jumping on, they do the trampoline thing where the characters leap through the air and they defy gravity, but you can still see that they're shackled by it. You hear them landing with a lot of heft every time. And that keeps happening. And you kind of, and I realize now after I've seen this many times, the reason why we hear them land so heavily is so that when the monks float through the air and we don't hear them land, that we get this sense of how untethered they are to the world. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's this whole dichotomy between the world of earthly concerns and this transcendent world that the monks are interested in. And I don't know, I found that juxtaposition, which it was sort of like, I think I unconsciously recognized it, but it was, I only consciously saw it on this last viewing. It just goes to show the filmmaking, because I've seen it so many times and it's taken me this long to notice something like that. And also the way that all leads into, well, because there's a quote, I want to give a quote from King Hu, because he talks about what he was trying. And again, this is a quote when he was on the film circuit. So he's obviously speaking with intention to an audience. What he was saying was, and I'll see if I can find it. Let's see. So he said, "I discovered that translating the concept of Zen into cinematic terms posed a great many difficulties. Not long after, I made an acquaintance of an old man who was a devout Buddhist. He told me that Zen is something that can't be explained, but can be experienced through Wu, which is the awakening to the truth." And then he goes on to say, "The only way to Wu is through you, which is example or analogy." And so he says, "I must add, however, that I am not a Buddhist myself and that I don't have the least intention of being didactic or evangelical in my approach to this matter. I am interested in presenting the flavor of a particular experience." And he had said, "Wu is not subject to logical analysis. It would be difficult, for example, to explain the concept of sweetness to someone who has never tasted sugar. But giving him a cube of it would be enough to enlighten him once and for all." So I feel like the movie is, and people have said this, this is not like anything new, but I thought the quote sort of adds an interesting dimension to it. He's trying to show the experience of Zen, but he can't explain it. And one of my notes on the movie was, if I understood Touch of Zen, I would stop watching it, but I keep coming back to it because I don't understand it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so
I feel like, and I've dabbled in Buddhism. I used to go to a temple where I learned to meditate. My wife is a Buddhist, and so I know a little bit about some of this. But I feel like the movie is sort of, I don't know how to put it. I feel like King Hu must have had some insight from his discussions with that Buddhist into the meaning of Zen. And he's trying to sort of convey that through the film. And the interesting thing to me is, what I didn't realize before I saw that quote for years and years is Hu is not a Buddhist. I always thought Hu was a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. When I first saw Raining in the Mountain, my initial interpretation of it was a more religious interpretation until I started looking into it and realized, oh, it's much more critical of religion than I thought. So I find it interesting that that the movie, like, you really see it in the scene where the Buddhist abbot gets stabbed, and instead of bleeding blood, he's bleeding gold. And it's similar to like the ending of 2001, where there's this transformation occurring on screen, but it's not done in a way where you really understand exactly what's going on.
That's a good comparison. I mean, the ending to this is very enigmatic, but it's absolutely fascinating. I think enraptured is a fair word for how I felt during the last 15 minutes or so of this movie.
Well, I guess the impression I'm getting is maybe the monk, he's obviously attaining some kind of enlightenment and maybe becoming a bodhisattva or something. I don't know what the intentions were, but we see this transformation that seems like a spiritual transformation of the character. And it begins with a lethal wound. And I think that then we see him become like this meditative figure where the monastery used to be. And then we see him pointing. And you're wondering, well, okay, what's the point? Like, he's obviously communicating to the figures that are watching him, which would be like the Zhu Feng character. And if General Shi is still alive, it's a little unclear. Maybe him and, maybe the sons of the, I don't know if they survived or not. I think they died. The sons of the official who tumbles off the cliff. But is he telling them to go back into the world? Is he telling them?
That was something I wondered about. That was an interpretation. I don't know that it is, but that was an interpretation that crossed my mind.
Well, and why that's significant is I go back to the look on the face of the Zhu Feng character when she gives up her daughter. And so I'm curious, again, I don't want to see a sequel to Touches That. I think that would ruin it. But there's a part of me that's like, wants to know, what did she do after that moment in the movie, after it ended? Did she go? And again, I don't know if the monastery, this is a very trippy scene, so I'm going to assume the monastery is still there, but did she go back to the monastery? Did she go and wander the world to seek enlightenment like the abbot? Did she go back to Gu and her child? Like, what did she do?
As I've only watched it once, I can't place this little clip precisely, but there is just a moment where it flat in that same vicinity of the scene where it flashes back to Gu as under the tree with the baby where he's sitting. Mm-hmm. And it's, and I'm like, is that going to the theory, is he telling her to go back into the world? That's kind of what put that idea in my mind. Is he saying, go back and, look after your kid or whatever. But it's very enigmatic. And But going back to the quote you were saying from
and I kind of butchered that quote, to be fair. So anybody that wants to read me for that, feel free. But you can find the quote on Notes on a Touch of Zen by King Hu on the Criterion Collection page and get a much clearer rendering of it. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I used to act in the theater a long time ago, and one of the things a lesson that always stuck with me as something you should add to every performance was this concept of mystery, which is that people should always be mysterious. If you've conceived a character in your head where everything totally makes sense in a logical way, you know, just, you know, cookie cutter. This person does this because of this and blah, blah, blah. Very pop psychology, predictable stuff. You've made a boring character. And you always kind of want to find, you always want the audience to wonder what you're going to do. It's like the part of the element of watching a movie is the mystery of it. You know, not literally a mystery, but what is this person thinking? What is this person going to do next? And yeah, I feel like what he's getting at with that is very, very similar idea to that, that this movie does have a lot of ambiguity and that's its strength. You never can fully unpack this movie.
No, and I agree. And I, just to go back to the 2001 reference, that's the reason I was so fascinated by 2001 is I had no idea, even though I read the book, I didn't really understand the ending. It took me forever. And the book clearly says, if I remember, the book clearly says what happens. But the movie is very difficult to sort of wrap your mind around at that end. And it's even kind of shot in a similar lethargic pace of it really forces you to sort of sit and soak in everything that it's showing you. And I think the ambiguity is the thing that keeps me coming back to it. If at the end they showed her go back to goo, then I would kind of already know and I wouldn't be curious about it anymore. You know, so I don't know. I find it very interesting. I also think it's one of these movies that just has so many layers of meaning that you can, you know, extract from it. So, but again, what I've been very curious about is, and as an example, like the scenes that really stand out in my mind are when you have the Buddhist abbot in sort of looking at another person in the film, usually an enemy, and the sunlight glaring behind him. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that, to me, that's sort of like the whole touch of Zen concept, is that imagery of, you know, like I get what you're, you know what I mean? Like I get what you're sort of trying to convey, sort of, but not fully. And so again, I think if King Hu had just said, well, Zen means X, Y, and Z. There you go.
Yeah.
Or I'm doing this. The reason I'm doing the scene this way is because of X, Y, and Z. You know, it would lose that. This is one of those movies where like you desperately want to know what the filmmaker is trying to do. You know, they're trying to do something and they've only given you just enough information so that you can keep doing the work yourself to sort of figure out in your own mind what you think is trying to be done. Do you know what I mean? Like, or maybe I'm just not enlightened enough or scholarly enough, but you know what I mean? I watched the movie and it's like, I know that this movie has this meaning. I know I want to know more about it. And I'm, you know, do you know what I mean? There's like a struggle in watching the movie that keeps me coming back to it.
It's the enigma of this movie is interesting because it's not like it makes it more abstract or arty. It's like, as I was saying, the fact these characters and the story and everything are mysterious makes it feel more realistic. It's like that's how the world is. You never quite wrap your head around it. So it actually gives it a feeling of reality by having that level to it.
Well, and that also, that level of reality feels violated when it veers into the supernatural, right?
Yes. So
that's also where I think that is an interesting thing about the film. Like the moment it starts, like, it's sort of vague, like the sunlight in the background, okay. You know what I mean? Like, that's not necessarily...
The sun just could happen to be there.
But when he's bleeding gold, like, then you're like, okay, something is going on here. You know?
I think we briefly talked about this a couple days ago, but it's like the movie starts very much like a ghost story. You really think this is going to be supernatural. There's going to be ghosts. This is going to be a spooky movie. And none of that actually happens. But then there is just this really transcendent ending that goes beyond normal reality at the end. So it's kind of a double switch. You've come accustomed to the fact, that there is nothing supernatural going on. That was all just a misdirection. But it's fantastic.
they even trample on the idea that it would be supernatural by having him fake a haunting at the man. You know, And also, I should say, this is based on a Pu Song Ling story. So it's based on a supernatural story. And you sort of start with almost the impression that that's where what it's going to be. And then because the title of the movie is not A Touch of Zen in Chinese, it's the same title as the Pu Song Ling story. I think it's Zhanu or something like Chivalrous Woman or something to that effect. And so presumably people that are familiar with the story would know what they're about to watch. So I think it is interesting that it does that. Like, it starts with the spider web and the, you know, and the
spider webs are another thing too, because as you have Yang and her allies kind of show up there, and there's just this mysterious interaction with her for a while, and all that spider web imagery made me think, are they luring him in? Are they using him somehow? Mm. Are they luring him in? It made me think, and maybe think the main character was kind of being pulled into some trap, and that's not the case at all. That was kind of an interesting element of the movie.
Yeah, the spiderweb. One thing I've heard is that it represents the entanglements of the material earthly world. I don't know if that could just be somebody saying something that sounds really. You know, I don't know, but. But I do. I read this story once a long, long time ago, because the thing about it is, I don't think it's in the Penguin edition. It is in, I have a 4-volume set, which
I have the Penguin edition, and I went nuts trying to find it in the Penguin. So I'm like, is it under a different title? Is it in here? No, it's not.
I have also the 4-volume Chinese classics edition, which does have it. But the problem with that is, number one, that version is at my apartment, so I can't look at it again now, or my old apartment. But it's 4 volumes, so it takes a long time sometimes to find the story, and you're not always sure of the title of the story. But I did find it. Read, if I recall, I think she may have been a spider spirit of some kind, but I could be wrong. I could be 100% wrong about that.
I read the Wikipedia synopsis of the story, but I've now forgot. Actually, I don't know if she was supernatural, if it was there's another character that isn't even this.
I read it a long time ago, so I could be completely wrong about that. The other thing, though, is I do remember when I was reading it at the time, the Wikipedia entry was very spotty in terms of accuracy. Maybe it's probably improved by now. So whatever you're reading, I would guess is probably closer to accurate. But what I'm saying is I
don't know. I'm not going to swear by the Wikipedia synopsis.
Well, at some point, if I find the story, maybe we'll cover it on the podcast again, because we've sort of raised the point. But the idea is basically wherever the direction of the supernatural in that story, it was a supernatural story. And so it's interesting that he sort of takes a supernatural story and then turns it into a mundane story where the only supernatural elements are about Zen Buddhism.
I feel like going back to this is a case where going back to the short story really doesn't help you, because it's like he took the seed. It's like the story formed a seed in his mind, and then he just formed something entirely different from it. So,
but I don't know. Do we have anything else to add on this one? We've been going for a while, going for 40 minutes for this mini podcast.
Yeah. I probably made all my major points here. Yeah, I'm okay with wrapping it up. But yeah, fantastic movie. I mean, you got to be someone who can be patient with a movie. It's like, if you just want to watch an action movie, this is not the one to watch. But this is a really, I found it very involving.
Yeah, if you can get it on Blu-ray, they've restored it wonderfully. Yeah. Like the first time I saw this was the really grainy, faded version that used to be available, and that in that version you couldn't even see the spider web at all in any, you know what I mean?
I was gonna say, there's a lot of night scenes in this, especially the whole kind of trap sequence where they lure the enemies in. It's like, I can imagine that being really hard to watch on a bad cop.
Those, when they were, but also the colors are so faded in those ones. The sound was quite terrible, as I recall. It was just not the same experience. If I remember, I think Zhu Feng somehow was involved or oversaw the restoration of this. And I feel like that really makes a difference, having an actress who is present on the set, who has some kind of emotional investment in the movie overseeing the restoration. It made me feel like, I mean, I don't know how true it is because I've never seen the original version, obviously, from the original film, but I felt like I was in good hands, at least, if her name was attached to it in that way. You know, but yeah, again, you can get it on Blu-ray. I have it on Blu-ray and DVD, but I ended up actually buying the digital version for watching it this time around, just because of the convenience of watching it on my computer. I think that the Blu-ray version I have, I think they're the same version, but I think my Blu-ray is better than the one that was on the streaming. Also, you can access the features on that one. You can't access the features on the streaming version. So I guess we'll let you go. And until next time, we will talk to you later.